dramatic gestures, but she bowed her head and swallowed thickly at the sight of the assembled Greenbones falling to their knees and crying out in a fervor, "Our blood for the horn!" The three largest and most profitable betting houses in the city were the Palace of Fortune, the Kong Lady, and the Double Double. They were located side by side on the same strip of Poor Man's Road in the south part of the armpit, still belonging to the mountain. Ranking among the mountain's most well-known holdings, they were where high-rolling lantern men conducted after-hours deals, and where the clan's business and political associates were rewarded or bribed with luxury and entertainment. A fitting place for an unprecedented retribution. Hilo had nodded in admiration of Shay's choice. "Lon fought for the armpit, and it's ours by right. All of it." They crossed Patriot Street with a dozen of No Peak's strongest fists. Shay took the Kong Lady with the four other fighters Hilo sent with her, while the Makes stormed the Double Double with another crew, and Hilo went with his team to destroy the Palace of Fortune. The whole thing felt like a violent fever dream to Shay. The car pulled up right in front of the casino. Shay got out and strode past the shocked valet attendant, who shrank aside at the sight of them, past the lighted fountain with the statue of the dancing lady in the center, up the marble steps to the revolving glass doors. No hiding in the crowd now. The waning sunlight flashed on her jade bracelets, and fearfully expectant eyes followed her every move. She felt sick with eagerness, and powerful in a way she hadn't felt for years. The foreigners were right. The Kekanese were savages. Lon had not been savage, not at heart, but he was dead now. The senior fist next to her, a gray-eyed man named Iten, seemed unsure of how to deal with her presence. He was one of Hilo's higher-ranked lieutenants, but she was a call. He couldn't decide whether to order her around or defer to her. "What's the plan, Kaljen?" he asked just before they reached the doors. She drew her moon blade and held it out to him. He spat on it for luck. "Kill anyone wearing jade," she said. That was simple enough to agree upon. Screams erupted when they came through the doors. Shay picked out the four other jade auras in the room like a cobra sensing body heat. They stood out like beacons amid the rest of the irrelevant motion and noise. A couple of them had already perceived the murderous approach and were ready. They leapt upon the intruders at once with drawn moon blades. It had been years since Shay had last fought to kill. For a few minutes on the drive over here, she'd wondered if she still had the skills, the reflexes, the instinct for it, or if 2.5 years of jadelessness and peaceable Aspenian life had ruined her. So she was almost surprised when she cut the first man down in a few seconds. She deflected his first attack, white metal singing against white metal, then made an obvious swing for his abdomen. The man steeled and curved his spine away from her attack. His head tilted forward with the motion, and Shay's left hand whipped up to thrust her talon knife into his unprotected throat. She bounded light over his body, yanking out the knife and already moving on to the next target. It felt like an exercise at the academy, another timed trial. Training and experience took over. She became focused and efficient, and the jade energy playing through her blood was like a song she hadn't heard for a while, but still knew by heart. She fought another man on the first floor until Iten cut his throat from behind. Shay leapt lightly onto the balcony of the second floor. A woman fist guarded the room where the staff had taken refuge. She greeted Shay with a battery of hurled deflections that overturned chairs, sent cards and betting chips into the air like confetti, and rattled the walls. Shay weaved through the barrage, scattering the attacks with her own deflections, until she closed in and they matched talon knives in the narrow hallway. The woman's steel could not be broken by the knife, In the end, Shay landed a crushing stomp kick to the woman's kneecap. As her opponent buckled forward in agony, Shay dropped her elbow down on the back of the fist's head with all the strength she could summon, caving in the skull. When every green bone in the building was dead, six in all, they tore the door to the back room off by its hinges, and Shay addressed the huddled, cowering staff members of the Kong Lady. "All the businesses on Poor Man's Road are now the property of the No Peak Clan," she said. "You can leave now with your lives, or you can swear allegiance and tribute and keep your jobs with equal terms and pay under new management. Make your choice quickly." A quarter of the employees left, the ones too senior or too well-connected in the Mountain Clan, who were truly loyal or too frightened of the repercussions if they turned. The rest stayed and recovered from the disruption remarkably quickly. The Kekanese are accustomed to local changes of administration and treat them like natural disasters, incidents of sudden and unpreventable violence, the damage calmly dealt with afterward so business can return to normal. Soon the remaining casino staff were busy righting furniture, sweeping up broken glass, and blotting bloodstains before they set into the expensive carpet or upholstery. Shay gathered the jade from the enemy fighters she'd killed, then walked outside, leaving Iten and the rest of Hilo's men in charge. She found her brother on the street, shouting orders, pointing here and there with the tip of his bloody talon knife, his face and aura bright with battle mania. The double-double was on fire. Whether it had been set accidentally or deliberately, by the mountain as it fled or by an overzealous no-peak fighter, no one seemed able to tell. The smoke curled out of the upper-story windows, mingling with the washed-out hues of the sky. Hilo glanced at her as she approached, at the handful of jade she clutched, and his mouth moved in something that was not quite a smile. He turned his face back toward the melee, the fire, the running people, the intermittent sounds of continued fighting, not just from Greenbones. People from the no-peak side of the armpit were pouring across Patriot Street. There was shouting and clashing in the streets between civilians rallying in support of one clan or another. "It's not enough," Hilo muttered. Shay was not sure what he was referring to. The amount of jade in her hands, the betting houses themselves, or the number of mountain greenbones killed that evening. She was too rattled to respond. It took another 30 minutes for the fire in the double-double to be put out and for the chaos to fade into silence of an eerie aftermath. At some point, when the sun sank out of the smoky sky, Hilo organized his people to carry on through the night, and Shay ended up in the rear seat of a car headed back to the Call House. It was all a blur to her by that point, a surreal art house film of revenge and brutality. Gaunt Ash took the phone call in silence, but every one of his men with any skill in perception shifted away from him. Gaunt felt cold with astonishment. Then his neck flushed red with rage. 21 members of the Mountain Clan were dead in the surprise attack. Fingers and Junior Fists, who'd hastened to defend the trio of betting houses on Poor Man's Road, but were no match for the killers Call Hilo had assembled from No Peak. A couple of foolish lantern men who had fired on the attackers were in the hospital. Every square inch of the armpit was under No Peak control. It was an outbreak of clan-on-clan violence such as John Loon had never seen. Gaunt hung up. For several seconds, he was motionless. Then he tore the phone and its casing off the wall and hurled it across the room with such force that it embedded into the far wall on the other side of the silver spur. His men froze, shocked by the uncharacteristic outburst. "Call Lon is dead," Gaunt said. "His family has come down from the forest. We are now at open war with No Peak. Their lives and livelihoods are for the taking, and Jade goes to the victor. Chapter 34. You Owe the Dead. Shay was confused when she woke up. It was the middle of the night, and she was in her childhood bedroom. She hadn't been in this room lately other than to pick up old clothes and belongings. When she opened her eyes, the moonlight dimly illuminating her room revealed a pile of blood-stained clothing and weapons on the floor next to her old globe lamp and a stack of paperback novels. She realized she'd crawled under the covers in nothing but her underwear and her jade. Everything came back to her then. Lan's death, putting on her jade and weapons, going with Hilo to wreak brutal vengeance on poor man's road. From deep inside, a pressure built and expanded like a balloon inside a box until a great sob ripped itself from her chest. She curled tightly onto her side, squeezing the pillow to her face, and wept, long and hard, until she ran out of tears and energy. Then she lay still, breathing raggedly, and took stock of her new and terrible reality. She'd been possessed. It was the only explanation, or perhaps merely an excuse. A dam that had been straining under hairline fractures had burst inside her yesterday, and instead of feeling appalled, she'd welcomed the final destruction, had reveled in it, in the sweet power of jade and the frenzy of violent retribution. In the cold clarity of the aftermath, however, she felt numb. She'd done something irreversible last night, equally cowardly and brave, and she wondered if this mixture of sadness, strange elation, and calm acceptance of what one would feel in the moments of free fall after jumping off a high bridge. One could not change fate after such a decision, only own the choice and anticipate its inevitable outcome. This thought, somehow, calmed her, and slowly her body unclenched. Perception told her she was not the only one awake. Now that she could once again sense jade auras as automatically as she discerned color, it seemed unthinkable that she would never again feel the cool, heavy texture of Lan's presence. Yet there it was, a truth more immutable and unforgiving than gravity on a falling body. Shay got out of bed and turned on a lamp. In her closet, she found an old t-shirt and a pair of sweatpants, clothes she hadn't bothered to move out. Slowly, she dressed herself. Her body and mind were sore. Regular training was still not the same as carrying and fighting with Jade. She had dark bruises and shallow cuts she hadn't noticed at all last night, and she suspected it would be more than a week before she could move or extend any Jade abilities without pain. In the mirror over the dresser, she saw that she looked battered and weary, more like a victim of domestic abuse than a greenbone warrior, except for the jade on her arms, her ears, her neck. She walked out of the room and down the unlit hall toward the glow of a single light emanating from downstairs. It was still dark out. The only sounds in the eerily quiet house were the ticking of the clock and the clinking of a spoon against ceramic. They seemed deafening. She descended the steps, walked into the kitchen, and saw Hilo sitting alone at the table, eating a bowl of hot cereal. He was still in his clothes from the previous day. His sheathed moonblade was propped against one of the other chairs, and his stained talon knife lay on the granite kitchen counter. He had not shaved, nor slept by the looks of it, but he was eating breakfast so calmly one might have been fooled into thinking nothing at all was out of the ordinary. Shay sat down silently in the seat opposite him. "There's a pot on the stove if you want some," he said after some time. "Kiana made it yesterday, but no one ate it. It's still good. Just add a little water."
"Where is everyone?"
Shay's voice sounded dry.
"Where's Granda?"
Hilo pointed the handle of his spoon up to the ceiling.
"In his room, probably still sedated. Kiangla had to call the doctor yesterday while we were gone. Sounds like you gave the old man some strong stuff to calm him down. Shay croaked.
What's wrong with him?
He's old and crazy. Hilo turned darkened eyes on her. He had a breakdown when he heard about Lon. He thought he was back in the war, and it was Dew that had been killed. He's been ranting and raving about the Chitaurians. Doesn't recognize me. When he does, he blames me. Says I'm the reason Lon's dead. Hilo said it with a flat affect to his voice, but Shay was not fooled. She wanted to rush up to see her grandfather, but if she got up now, Hilo would be hurt, and it seemed dangerous to hurt him right now. Their grandfather had always been kinder to Shay than to her brothers, and he had always been the least kind to Hilo. Hilo went back to eating, and she wondered, how can he even eat right now? She hadn't eaten in over a day, but had no appetite at all. She wasn't sure she ever would again.
What about everyone else?
They're busy, Shay, he said. We're stretched thin. I left Ken in charge of the mess. I sent Tar running around the city to make sure we're defended elsewhere. Shay sat up as something else occurred to her.
Where's Doru?
Hilo's lips went crooked. The traitor? We picked him up that night, you know. Lon was supposed to meet us, to handle it himself. I called, but couldn't reach him. No one knew where he was. That's when I knew something was wrong.
Did you kill Doru?
Hilo shook his head. That was gonna be Lon's call. So what was I supposed to do with the old ferret? Anyway, I stripped him of his jade and locked him in his house under guard. He's been there ever since. No phones, no visitors. Stripped of jade. What abject humiliation for an elderly greenbone who'd once been the trusted confidant of the Torch of Kaycon. Despite her hatred for the man, Shay imagined him in the advanced throes of jade withdrawal, watched over by Hilo's unsympathetic men in his own house, and she felt pity for him, traitor or not. I can't execute him now, Hilo said. I wouldn't taint Lon's funeral with bad luck like that. But he's no longer Weatherman. I've made that clear to the clan. Only then did the realization truly strike her. Hilo was the pillar. She stared at her brother. There had never been a pillar under the age of 30. Hilo was barely older than she. He'd been the youngest horn in memory. There he sat, blood spattered and reeking of fire smoke, eating a bowl of cereal after having led a massacre. His aura had the sharp edge of new jade he'd taken. Shay reeled. This will be the end, she thought. This will be the end of the No Peak clan. Hilo's spoon clattered into his empty bowl. The chair scraped back loudly as he got up from the table. He probably didn't even need to perceive her emotional reaction. It was on her face, but he said nothing. The new pillar placed his dishes in the kitchen sink, then washed and dried his hands. He grabbed a chair and pulled it up in front of Shay's, then sat back down and took her by the elbows, their knees touching. They'll come after us now, he said, with everything they have. Yes, she agreed. Ait Mada might have bargained with Lon. After last night, after what Shay and Hilo had done, there would be no mercy. The mountain would come down from the forest and would not rest until the remaining calls were dead. Their closest allies would be executed. This house would be burned to the ground. The remnants of the clan would be absorbed into the mountain. I need you, Shay. The strain on Hilo was showing at last. Every line of his face looked sharper than before. I know we haven't always agreed. I know I've said things, gone too far at times. Only ever because you're my sister, and I love you. Even if you're still angry with me, I know you care about the clan. Granda built it, and Lon died for it. And now I need your help. I can't do this without you. His grip on her tightened.
He bent forward and tilted his head to look up into her downcast face, his unwavering gaze a solemn plea. Shay, I need you to be my weatherman. Only a few days ago, she'd insisted to Andin that she'd put clan issues and the life of a greenbone behind her. Don't get involved. Don't worry. Lan doesn't need help. These problems aren't your problems. Selfishness, hubris, dispassion. The opposite of the divine virtues she'd contemplated when she'd knelt in the temple of divine return and prayed for a sign, an unequivocal message. She'd gotten what she'd asked for. The gods were often cruel. Everyone knew that. If no peak held any hope of surviving, the pillar needed a weatherman he could trust. Who else in the clan could stand up to Hilo? Who else could moderate him, could keep him from getting himself killed and taking the clan down with him? Lan's spirit would never be at peace if that happened. It's not true that the dead don't care, Shay thought. You owe the dead. Shay slid slowly from the chair and knelt on the cold kitchen tile. She raised clasped hands to her forehead. The clan is my blood, and the pillar is its master. On my honor, my life, and my jade. Chapter 35. An Unexpected Reception. The one thing Barrow was not short on was cash. There was an all-night clinic in the forge, one of a few in the city where doctors of questionable training patched up wounds with no questions asked, so long as one could pay for the service. In the early morning after the events at the pier, at roughly the same time that Kal Lan's body was being found, Barrow sat on a steel table under a buzzing strip of fluorescent light, while a wrinkled man with watery eyes and strings of hair like dirty floss pulled two shallowly embedded bullets from his arm and bandaged him up. Unrolling the gauze with such slow deliberation, Barrow wanted to smack him. He'd spent hours huddled in the bushes under a freeway overpass and felt quite mad by now. By the time he got out of the clinic, the news was raging through the city. Barrow overheard it while standing in line to buy a meat bun and soda from the first convenience store he found. Kal Lan, pillar of No Peak, was dead, suspected to have been assassinated by the mountain. Barrow's pulse pounded wildly. He was confused, but a grin rapidly spread across his face, and he had to force it down. It was only luck, the sweet, merciful luck of the gods, that he was alive at all, while that dumb turd Cheeky was dead. But now Barrow was certain that even more luck was showering down on him. It had been dark, and he'd run in a panic. He hadn't noticed it, but Kal must have been hit by the barrage of gunfire after all. He'd just taken longer than usual to die, which meant he, Barrow, had killed the pillar of No Peak. He began to grin again. No one else, not a single greenbone in the city, could say that. He kicked himself for running, for not returning to the pier to check. It took him the better part of the day to get all the way back to the Goody Two at the far south end of Junko. He bought new clothes and a hat, and threw the old ones in a trash bin. Then he walked, not trusting anyone, including cab or bus drivers, in case any witnesses had seen him last night and the clan was searching for him. This was loyal No Peak territory, and many people were upset. Barrow saw a lot of somber faces, crowds of people huddled at the windows of electronics shops to watch the local news on television, even weeping in public. The sight warmed Barrow more, put a spring into his weary steps. These people on the street, they'd lynch him if they knew what he'd done. They'd string him up, cut him to pieces, light his remains on fire. On his third attempt at knocking, Moot opened the back door of the Goody Two. He stared aghast at Barrow as if he were a ghost,
then yanked him inside by the arm and shut the door.
Go out front and keep watch. Shout if you see anyone coming.
Moot yelled over his shoulder at his son, who put down the box he was carrying and hurried to do as he was told. Moot turned back to Barrow.
What the fuck happened?
I did it,
Barrow said.
I killed Call.
To his surprise, Moot looked horrified.
Where's Cheeky?
Cheeky's dead.
Moot's mouth moved like an airless carp's. Finally, he said,
Fuck the gods. Fuck.
He paced back and forth a few times, shaky fingers pulling at his wiry mop of hair. He spun on Barrow with suddenness.
You have to get out of here, now.
Barrow grew angry. This was not the reception he'd expected.
What for? I spent the whole goddamn day walking here. You don't know what kind of night I've had. I did it. I killed Call. So pick up the phone and call him, that green bone. I did what he asked, and I want in now. I want my jade. I deserve it. No question now. You dumb fuck,
Moot spat.
No one told you to kill Call. You were supposed to shoot up the Lilac Divine and drive away. Give Call a scare in his own territory. Ruin his car and one of his favorite businesses. Piss him off, not kill him. The idea that you two halfwits could kill a greenbone like Call Lon.
Moot gave a derisive, snorting laugh. Soberly,
we're fucked. The mountain wants Call dead, don't it?
Barrow demanded, refusing to believe what he was hearing.
Make a big statement. That's what the greenbone said we were supposed to do. You telling me you never thought we could do it? A man with as much jade as the pillar? You're not gonna take him out with a fully gun spray from two kids who can barely shoot straight. We figured you'd cause a panic, maybe hit a few bystanders and be lucky to get away alive. I don't even know how it's possible that you did it. How you're even here.
Moot trailed off in disbelief, then seized Barrow by the upper arm and began pulling him across the back room cluttered with boxes, papers, and cleaning supplies. Barrow yanked his arm away.
What are you doing?
Moot opened a closet door. He pushed aside a wheeled filing cabinet and rolled aside a flap of carpet to reveal a trap door in the floor.
He already phoned once, asking if you'd come back here,
Moot said, tugging on a big brass ring to pull the door open.
He'll come back around here today, any minute now. If he finds you, you're a dead man, KK. If you're lucky, they'll just kill you for screwing things up. If you're not, they'll hand you over to No Peak as an offering. Well, it's probably too late for any of that. They say No Peak's horn is already on the warpath. So you're saying I should run? Gods, you really are missing some lights upstairs, aren't you?
Moot muttered. He pointed down into the opening in the floor.
I don't think anyone saw you come in, and better not to take any chances on them seeing you leave. The tunnel goes all the way down under Summer Park and lets out near the water. Dead useful for smuggling, and it'll be dry this time of year. If you're lucky enough to have lived this long, maybe you'll be lucky enough to get the hell out of John Loon.
Out of John Loon? Barrow exclaimed.
How? I'm not helping you there, KK, Moot said. This is as much as I'm doing. If the mountain finds out I'm even doing this, they'd cut my tongue out for starters.
He paled.
Goodbye, Jade. Goodbye, Shine. Goodbye, eating solid food.
Barrow squinted at Moot.
Then why are you doing it?
The man paused and looked at Barrow as if he was seriously asking himself the same question. Then he grimaced as if he didn't like his own answer.
You made me a shitload of money and never got caught, even though most of the others got caught. And then somehow, by some dumb kind of miracle I can't even fathom, you killed Call Lon and show up with nothing but a bandage on your arm. I don't know what it is with you, KK, But you got some strange luck of the gods on you, and I'm not messing with that. No way!
He pointed at the set of stairs leading underground.
Don't touch a thing down there! Now get, before I change my mind.
Barrow couldn't believe this was happening. He'd done everything right, taken every opportunity presented to him, been daring where others had been meek. And this is what he got for it? Earlier, he'd felt near invincible, convinced his rewards were finally coming to him. Now he saw that it was nothing more than a horrible joke. He thought about refusing to leave. He'd wait right here in the back of the Goody Two until that goateed green-boned bastard showed up, and then he'd demand his due. Moot was right, though. There was some strange luck on him, and it was best not to question it. Just as it had told him to chase after Call last night, it told him now that if he stayed, he wouldn't live long enough for his fortune to turn again. He started down the tunnel.
It's dark down there, he protested.
Moot handed him a flashlight, and he switched it on. When he got to the last of the steps, Moot slammed the trapdoor shut, and Barrow jumped. He heard Moot rolling the filing cabinet back into place overhead, and a sudden sick panic gripped him by the throat. What if this wasn't an escape route after all, but a trick? What if Moot had trapped him down here, to hand over to either one of the clans later, or simply to die? Barrow swung the flashlight around. The beam shook with his fear, dancing over unlabeled crates and boxes. This must be where Moot kept his most valuable contraband. Under other circumstances, Barrow would have been eager to open them up and take a look. But when the yellow circle of his flashlight passed over the nearby items and disappeared down a long, beckoning tunnel, relief opened into Barrow's veins, and he hurried toward it, away from the hated sting of being wronged yet again.
Chapter 36. Let the Gods Recognize Him. At least, Hilo thought, it was not raining. Lon's funeral procession wound its long, slow way through the streets to the family's ancestral burial grounds on a hillside cemetery in Widow's Park, not far from Call Ducheron Academy. There was no threat of violence. It would be unthinkable bad luck to intercept a Greenbone's final death parade, but the tension was palpable, hanging as low over the ceremony as the thick late autumn clouds. 4 days of illusory calm had descended over John Loon while the clans buried their dead. No peak had returned the bodies of the Greenbones slain in the bedding houses so the mountain could hold rites for them. In the no peak parts of the city, ceremonial spirit guiding lamps had gone up in the windows of homes and businesses to honor Kal Lon, grandson of the torch, pillar of the clan. Let the gods recognize him. Hilo had been walking directly behind the hearse for hours. Shay and Mate Ken, the newly appointed horn, walked side by side behind him. After them came the heads of the other prominent families in the clan, all of them fists, luckbringers, or lantern men, and behind them, a long trailing crowd of other clan loyalists who joined the march to pay their respects. Wen was back there somewhere with Tar. Hilo would have liked to have her up here with him, but they were not yet married. The nuptials had been indefinitely postponed. Instead of planning his wedding, he was walking in his brother's funeral. It was customary for family members to hold 2 days and nights of silent vigil over the white cloth-draped coffin before the funeral, and Hilo had slept no more than 4 hours astretch in the days before that, so his exhaustion had taken on a kind of hellish quality. Every few minutes, the funeral gongs and drums would raise an awful din from the front of the hearse, calling down the attention of the gods to observe Lon's passage into the spirit world, and jolting Hilo to continue putting one foot in front of the other. It was said that one must not speak or sleep during the vigil, because if the spirit of the deceased had any final messages to pass on, it would do so during that time. If nothing happened, that meant the loved one had moved on from the earthly realm and was at peace. That was further evidence, in Hilo's opinion, that spiritual sayings were full of shit. Lan's ghost, if it was out there, was not at peace, and Hilo was certain it would have things to say to him if it could. "You're no pillar," it would say. "I was born for it, trained for it, and look at how it killed me. You think you can do any better? Granda always said you were good for nothing but thuggery." "Shut up," Hilo murmured, though he knew it wasn't really Lan he was speaking to, only his own fears speaking in his brother's voice. Last night, in a moment of sleep-deprived, superstitious weakness, he'd laid his hands on the hilt of Lan's moonblade and strained his perception out so far that dozens of auras and hundreds of heartbeats chorused in his mind like white noise. He hadn't felt the barest hint of Lan's presence. No spirit had appeared or spoken to him during the vigil, not even to say, "Don't worry, brother. You'll be joining me soon enough." They reached the cemetery at last. The hearse climbed slowly up to the burial ground where a new plot had been dug next to the green marble family monument where Hilo's father and other forebears were buried. Three deitist penitents wearing white funerary robes were waiting to perform the final rituals. Hilo's mother was standing by Kal Sen, who sat in a wheelchair by the gravesite, Kianla holding a shade over him, even though it was overcast. They had been driven here ahead of the procession. Kal Wan Rhea, fetched from the cottage in Morenia, had the bent posture of someone who had long ago stopped questioning or fighting the world. Her grieving eyes were as dull as those of an old doll. The patriarch was motionless, his gnarled hands gripping the arms of the chair like tree roots sunken into clay. Hilo embraced his mother, though she returned the gesture with limp arms and barely seemed to see him. Lan had been the most dutiful of her children, more than her other two put together. "I love you, Ma," Hilo said. She didn't reply. The gray in her hair stood out more starkly than ever, and she looked lumpy in shapeless white funeral clothes. Out of the entire family, the shock was perhaps greatest for her. Hilo doubted Lan had conveyed much to their mother about the situation between the clans in the city. Complicit in her ignorance, she was now enduring the greater part of pain, and Hilo was forced to make a mental note to himself that she ought to be moved closer to the family, or help hired in Morenia to better care for her. He went next to his grandfather and knelt respectfully, clasping his hands and touching them to his head. "Granda." He rose to his feet and bent to kiss the hateful old man on his forehead. As he leaned over, he half expected his grandfather to shoot out a claw-like hand and crush his windpipe in front of all the onlookers. Kal Sen's fingers twitched, but he merely glowered at his remaining grandson with vague disdain. Hilo moved aside, letting Shay step in to stand beside the chair and take their grandfather's hand.
"Where's Doru?" he heard the old man grumble to her.
Hilo had been worried about his grandfather being there. Kal Sen was even more unpredictable now. What might he say? Would he loudly denounce Hilo in public, or start ranting about how wonderful his son Du had been? Now, though, Hilo relaxed a little. It was good that Granda was here. In the wheelchair, he looked frail and confused. Clearly, just a broken old man, no longer the torch of Kakon. There were those in the clan, Hilo knew, the old guard, who might have agitated for Kal Sen to step back into the clan's leadership position. Now they would see that it wasn't possible. Hilo took up a spot next to the coffin. As the other members of the clan arrived, he observed whether they came first to him to pay their respect to the new pillar, or whether they went to offer whispered condolences to Kal Sen. Most came to him, as custom dictated. Some did not. Enough for Hilo to know his position as pillar was far from universally accepted. He kissed Wen chastely on the cheeks when she came up with Tar. She was lovely, even in the white face powder that signified mourning and washed out the normal glow of her complexion. She slid her hand into his briefly as his lips touched her face.
"Don't mind those old men,"
she whispered, as if reading his mind, or more simply, noticing how he glanced at the cluster of guests who had not yet come and addressed him as Pillar.
"They haven't accepted reality yet."
"Some of them are powerful,"
Hilo replied quietly.
"Some are councilmen." "Councilmen are useless in a war,"
Wen said.
"The Lantern Men don't need regulations or tax breaks right now. They need protection. They need the clan's strength. Look at all the fists here, how they rally to you. Everyone else in the clan sees that too."
She squeezed his fingers, then went to stand by her brothers. Hilo scanned the crowd until he spotted Anden standing off to the side. He caught his cousin's eye and motioned for him to join the rest of the family. Anden hesitated, then walked over. He looked racked with grief, the poor kid. His eyes rimmed and his face almost as drawn and pale as Lon's drowned corpse when Hilo had first laid eyes on it. Hilo said gently,
"What are you doing alone over there, Andy? You belong over here with us."
Anden's face twitched like it was being barely held together, but he nodded mutely and took up his place next to Shay. The gongs and drums sustained a final crash of noise that made Hilo's head hurt and then fell silent, as did the crowd. The senior penitent, a learned one, glided forward and began to lead the long, low, chanting recitations that would usher Lon's spirit to the afterlife, where it would reside peacefully until the long-awaited return, when all of humanity would be admitted back into the fold of heaven to reclaim their lost kinship with the gods. Hilo tuned out after a few minutes. He moved his lips to echo the chants in all the appropriate places, but he had never had faith in things he could not see or feel with his own formidable senses. Deism, indeed all religion, made a complicated story out of truths that were simple but hard for people to accept. Jade was a mysterious but natural substance, not a divine gift or the remnants of some heavenly palace. The Kekanese were genetically fortunate, like the first monkeys with opposable thumbs, but that was all. People weren't descended from the gods, and they wouldn't return to being gods. People were people. The power of Jade didn't make them better or closer to godliness. It just made them more powerful. Hilo studied the somber crowd. It was populated with influential lantern men, business owners, corporate executives, judges, politicians. They were here with white envelopes of special tribute money to defray the cost of Lon's funeral and to publicly proclaim their continued allegiance to the clan. At this point, it was a gesture, not a promise. The true strength of their commitment would be revealed over the coming weeks and months. It depended on what happened next, on which way the clan war turned. Hilo glanced left and right, at his family arrayed around him at the front of the gathered mourners. Today he was putting on a display for the clan. Shay as weatherman, the fearsome Make brothers as Horn and First Fist, his fiancée, and his talented teenage cousin, all standing together. A confident public declaration that the younger generation of No Peak was still strong, that it would ensure the clan had a future. He hoped that for now, it would be enough. The sermon ended with several more murmured refrains of "Let the gods recognize him," and then everyone faced the coffin and watched as it was lowered into the earth. Hilo would have to stand and accept the condolences of lingering well-wishers for some time. He wished he could lie down on the ground and pass out instead. Shay, who'd kept vigil with him, stood erect, staring ahead, one hand supporting their mother's arm. Kal Sen looked slumped and lost in his chair. People began to mingle and converse in hushed tones. It was all extremely depressing.
Here comes Chancellor Soane,
Shay whispered at him.
The ruddy, overweight politician approached and placed his white envelope tactfully in the collection dish by the grave.
Call Jen,
he said gravely, turning and raising his hands in a salute, but not, Hilo noticed, holding it for long or tilting into any semblance of a bow.
My heart is unspeakably heavy for your loss. Thank you for being here to mourn with us, Chancellor,
Hilo said.
Your brother wasn't Pillar for nearly as long as he deserved. He was a reasonable and wise leader who always thought of the needs of the country and never forgot a friendship shown to the clan. I never had anything less than the greatest respect for Kaal Lan. He will be greatly missed.
He will, Hilo agreed, making the effort to keep his face neutral, for it could not be clearer that the Chancellor was pressing a message upon him, and was already, with his shrewd gaze, making unfavorable comparisons between the old Pillar and the new.
Soane conveyed himself with the smooth words of a diplomat, but Hilo didn't need perception to sense that the man's wariness and ambivalence emanated all down the line of Lantern Men here today. They relied on the clan for protection and patronage, and when they looked at Hilo, they saw his obvious youth and violent reputation. After today, Shay would tally the monetary contributions, and then he'd have a better idea of where he stood, how much he needed to worry. As much as he wanted to take comfort in what Wen had said, Hilo knew that it didn't matter how many loyal fists he had. If he lost the support of the Lantern Men, if they began to defect to the mountain, then he would lose the clan. He turned, with reluctance, to politely greet the next one who followed on Soane's heels to deposit his envelope and pay respect. When at last the line of guests had finally thinned and the crowd began to disperse, Anden came up.
Hilo-chan, he said tentatively, I have to talk to you.
The teen's face was contorted, as if he were in physical pain. When he spoke, his words were rushed, his expression that of a man pleading forgiveness for some terrible crime.
There's something I didn't tell you when I should have. If only I'd...
Hilo drew his distressed cousin aside.
What is it, Andy?
Lon had me run errands for him before he died. He had me go to this place and pick up packages and bring them to him without telling anyone.
Anden's agonized whisper was wound as tight as a wire.
Lan was acting strange when I saw him last. Angry, not like himself. And his aura was different, too sharp. The packages, they were vials, Hilo. Vials of...
Hilo seized the lapel of Anden's suit and pulled him forward. He gave a single sharp shake of his head.
Don't say it.
His voice was low and angry. Anden fell silent and stared at him, frozen. Hilo's expression was chiseled from stone. He leaned in and spoke near Anden's ear.
Lan was the first of this family, the pillar of our clan. The mountain killed him, and I'm gonna make sure they pay for it. And no matter what, I won't have anyone sullying my brother's memory or casting doubt on the strength of the family. Ever.
His grip on Anden's lapel tightened as he drew back enough to lock gazes.
What you just said to me now, have you said it to anyone else at school?
No,
Anden said, eyes wide.
No one.
Don't ever mention it again.
Anden's throat moved, but no sound emerged. He nodded. Hilo's fingers loosened, and his fierce expression melted. He straightened out the front of Anden's suit jacket and put his hands on the teen's shoulders.
It eats at me too, Andy. What else I could have done? I should have paid more attention. I should have had guards following him that night.
It doesn't matter now. What happened has happened, and we can't change it. It wasn't your fault. Not in the slightest. Anden did not look at him. He swiped his eyes with the back of his hand. Hilo hated seeing him riddled with sorrow and guilt like this. He asked softly, Do you need some time off? Do you want me to talk to the academy?
Anden shook his head at once.
No, I want to graduate on time.
That's good. Lan would have wanted that. Hilo tried to give his cousin a comforting smile, but Anden still wouldn't look up. The teen nodded and pulled away, retreating towards some academy classmates standing with their families a short distance away. Hilo let out a tired breath as he watched his cousin go. He hadn't meant to speak so harshly, but Anden would be taking oaths soon, coming into the clan at a time of war. It was important that he understand. In a Greenbone clan, legacy was crucial. Lan's authority had rested on the legacy of his grandfather and father, and Hilo would rest also on his brothers. The clan was like a body. The Lantern Men were skin and muscles, the Fists and Luckbringers like heart and lungs, but the pillar was the spine. There could be no weakness in the spine, or the body could not stand. It could not fight. Lan had been ambushed by their enemies and had fallen as a warrior. There must never be any doubt of that. Hilo said to Tar, "Get the rest of these people out of here. I want to be alone." Tar and Ken ushered the remaining guests gently but firmly back down to the cemetery gates. Shay bowed her head for a long moment. Her lips moved as if she was saying something silently to Lan's coffin. Then she turned and walked away, guiding their mother's slow steps. Wen came up to Hilo and put a questioning hand on his arm. "Go with your brothers," he told her. "I'll follow." She did as he asked. Kal Sen remained by the open grave with Kianla standing patiently behind his wheelchair.
"He was a good boy," the old man said finally. "A good son."
Suddenly, Kal Sen began to weep. He cried with the silent, ugly face of someone who was embarrassed to do so, who thought tears were for the feeble. Kianla tried to comfort him, handing him tissues from her purse.
"Ah, there, there, Kaljen. It's okay to cry. We're all human. We all need to cry to feel better, even the pillar."
Kal Sen took no notice of her. Hilo looked away. Seeing the old man weep made his chest heavy as lead. His grandfather was an insufferable tyrant, but his life had been more tragic than anyone deserved. All his military and civic achievements, public accolades and decades of rule over the family and the clan could not compensate for the fact that he'd buried his only son, and now his eldest grandson. When his grandfather had broken down in dementia and been sedated days ago, Hilo had instructed Dr. True to remove and lock away some of the old man's jade, a few stones from his belt to start. The doctor said it would help. It would make Granda less likely to hurt himself or others. It would dull his senses, slow his metabolism, make him calmer. When he awoke, Kal Sen did not seem to even notice his missing jade, a sad sign in itself, but Hilo did. The torch's once indomitable aura was already a shadow of what it used to be. Loss of jade only made that more apparent. Seeing him like this now, Hilo knew with abrupt certainty that his grandfather did not have long to live. There would be another Kal family funeral soon, though he wasn't going to wager on whose it would be. Hilo knew he was the least loved of all his grandfather's progeny, but he made himself go to Kal Sen's side.
"It's all right, Granda," he said quietly.
"You made the clan stronger than any one of us." He crouched next to the wheelchair.
"Don't worry. I'm gonna take care of things. I'm not Du or Lan, but I'm still a Kal. I'll make things right. I promise."
He didn't know if his grandfather heard him or cared, but the old man stopped weeping and dropped his chin to his chest, closing his eyes. Hilo had Kianla push him back to the car. Hilo stood alone by Lan's grave at last. And even though he didn't believe in heaven or ghosts, there were things that needed to be said.
"Your jade, brother.
I had it sewn under the lining of the coffin. No one took it from you, and no one else will ever wear it. It's yours. He was silent for a minute. I know you don't think I can do this, but you didn't leave me any choice, did you? So I'm going to prove you wrong. I won't let it happen. I won't let no peak fall. If there is an afterlife, when you see me again, you tell me if I kept the oaths I made to you. Chapter 37 The Weatherman's Pardon. Shay went to the weatherman's house, where two men kept Yoon Dorupon under constant guard. The two men were junior fingers who would be no match for a senior greenbone, but they did not need to be, not when their captive no longer possessed any jade. One man stayed by the front door to keep people away, and one stayed inside to keep Doru from getting out. They carried handguns only, not even their talon knives, so their prisoner had no chance of getting his hands on a jade-hilted weapon. When Shay approached, the sentry said,
"Hilo-Gen said no one's to go in."
Even these junior fingers referred to Hilo in the familiar, as if they were his personal friends. "This is the weatherman's house," Shay said. "I'm the weatherman, so this is my residence. The man in there is a temporary guest, and I intend to speak to him." When the finger still hesitated, Shay said, "It'd be better if you were to simply report me to my brother, rather than get in my way." The finger considered his position relative to hers, and let her in. The inside of the house was dark even in the middle of the morning. All the blinds were shut, and the ceiling fan circulated warm, stuffy air that smelled of cloves and musty sweaters. Doru did not throw anything away. The house was filled with uncoordinated furniture, houseplants, and all manner of random gifts accumulated from decades as weatherman. Statuettes and little ornate boxes, colorful vases, and carved paperweights, throw rugs, and ebony coasters. In one corner of the living room, by the window, the other guards sat in a chair, looking bored. Doru was lying stretched out lengthwise on the sofa, a wet folded towel over his eyes.
"Is that you, Shaysa?"
"Doruja," Shay caught herself. "Hello, Uncle Doru." The former weatherman was no longer entitled to the suffix he'd held most of his life. Doru lifted the towel from his eyes and shifted his lanky limbs, sitting up slowly and gingerly, as if he was unfamiliar with his body and suspicious it might break. Without his jade, he looked gaunt and creaky. The former weatherman licked his dry, thin lips and squinted at Shay, as if making sure it was her.
"Ah," he breathed, leaning his head back and closing his eyes, as if already exhausted merely from moving. "How did you manage, Shaysa? Going through this by yourself, so far from home."
She had been young and healthy, better able to endure the headaches, crushing fatigue and panic attacks of jade withdrawal. Doru was nearly as elderly as her grandfather. She couldn't help wondering if a quick death wouldn't have been a kinder fate for him than this humiliating ordeal.
"It gets easier after the first 2 weeks," she told him.
"I know, Shaysa," Doru sighed. "This isn't the first time I've been jade-stripped and imprisoned. At least this time I'm in the comfort of my home instead of a Shatarian torture cell."
He moved his fingers in a no-matter gesture.
"I don't expect it to last as long, though. Come closer. I can't hear you that well anymore. Sit down, and do tell me why I'm still alive."
Shay picked her way over to the armchair and sat down across from the man.
"Lan's funeral, Uncle," she said. "It was yesterday."
Water gathered under Doru's papery eyelids and slipped out of the corner of his eyes, tracing thin tracks down the side of his face, like estuaries seeking a route through a landscape of wrinkles.
Why him? He was always such a good, thoughtful man. A dutiful son. Oh, Lanza, why were you so foolish? So good.